But the changing part for me was when I went into the Craigan Chapel, where I went every Sunday and I saw 13 coffins on the altar. At that time, you realized then that the British soldiers were not friendly people. You know, there was a fear that came over me about British soldiers. Run along the bottom of the playground, and soldier fired a rubber bullet, which hit me in the bridge of the nose and blinded me permanently. So I was only about 10 feet away from it.
Richard, thanks very much for sitting down and joining me. I appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
We'll get into your whole story there, but given that you were born in what, 1962?
61.
61. Okay, so you got you did get almost up until the age of 10 to live in like the troubles free environment. Not that there
Yeah.
wasn't tensions and so on. Do you remember much from those years before the conflict kind of kicked off?
Absolutely. Like, I remember I grew up in a place called the Craigan Estate. And for anybody that's not familiar with Derry or the city where we live, the city is it's very hilly, and there's a river that goes through the city, the River Foyle, and that divides the city to the between the East Bank and the West Bank. Or the East Bank is known as the Waterside, the West Bank is known as the Derry Side. And I lived on the West Bank, which is the Derry Side, and the Craigan was up on the hill, sloping down towards the Bogside, and then the Bogside, then you come towards the city centre, and then that's the river. So up there in the Craigan, it was a lovely place to live. It was a big housing area, social housing, had all the usual, you know, things about the unemployment and all the issues that come with it. But my memory of Derry and the Craigan was a very happy, peaceful, lovely place to live. And then what seemed like overnight to me, around 1968, 69, I suppose, when I would have been 7 or 8, know, everything suddenly changed, and you had riots. You know, it was a crazy thing to see the local people from the area digging up the pavements and breaking up the pavements and using the rubble to build barricades at the end of each street. Or to use missiles that they threw at the British Army or the police or whatever it was at the time. And you know, you'd see people driving around, and you know, young men, they were probably 17 or 18, but to me they seemed like real adults, and driving around and hijacked, you know, small dumper trucks, you know, and filling the buckets of them with bottles and stones and that, and picking them all down to the where the riots were happening and stuff. And then you had, you know, it just things escalated from there, you know. So I do remember it very well.
I see. Even before like the troubles kind of kicked off in earnest, were you aware of like any kind of boiling tensions or any simmering of any kind?
Not really. I think I knew about the marches. You know, we could see the graffiti, you know, like on the middle of the road in our street. Written on the ground was "One Man, One Vote," and that was obviously a statement where, because the voting system in Northern Ireland was rigged in a certain way that, you know, if you're a businessman, you're entitled to a vote. If you owned your own house, you're entitled to another vote. If you're a director of a company or multiple companies, then you had a vote for every directorship that you had. So that was obviously about that, but I read it many, many times as a child, but I never understood what it meant really. So, you know, you would have been aware of civil rights, for example. You would have been aware, heard, you know, I come from a big family, John, you know, and so I was the second youngest. So you would have been sitting in the house, and you know, we're a big family, 12 children in the house, 9 boys and 3 girls. And, you know, you've been sitting there and maybe having your dinner or whatever, and your brothers would have been coming in, your sisters would have been coming in. They would have been talking about things and all of that. So you would have it would have registered with you to some degree. And then, of course, you had the television where you would have saw, say, the famous march where, you know, where the Jerry Fitt, who was one of the political leaders at the time, was beaten to the ground by the police in the streets of Derry. You know, the march had started in Duke Street in Derry, the Civil Rights March. You would have heard the people singing, "We Shall Overcome," and all that. In fact, I can remember as a child, a young person, anyway, that age, you know, where me and my friends used to sing, you know, "We Shall Overcome." So where did we hear that? Obviously, we picked it up, you know, as they would say, between the swings and the roundabouts. You know, you'd have picked it up from family, you'd have picked it up from other people in the area, you'd have picked it up from what you saw on TV and that. So you were aware of it, but were you really aware of what was happening? Probably not.
Interesting. Did you feel I guess like before your teens, I don't know how much you would be, but like were you aware on some level that you were like part of a minority, that you know, that there were people who didn't like you kind of just because you were Catholic, or were you aware of any of that?
At that young age, now everything I'm talking about is how I felt at that, or what I understood at that time.
Right.
I was 10, I was 8 or 9 years of age. So I didn't really get the concepts that much. I was aware that, you know, that there was some level of discrimination, or some level of wrongdoing. Maybe discrimination is too big a word for a child at that age to even be aware of, and I don't think I was. But you were aware that, you know, that your brothers weren't getting jobs, that they weren't, you know, they were going for you know, simple jobs like a message boy for a shop or something. And, you know, you would have heard conversation about, you know, the once a guy interviewing asked you what school you went to, then they knew you were a Catholic and you didn't get the job, sort of thing. Now, but I'm being honest, like, you know, with 8 or 9 years of age, before the conflict kicked off proper, then you weren't fully clued into it all. It's only really when, you know, I got to maybe 9 or 10, let's say. And particularly 1969, and the real flare-ups, and then the riots on the streets of Derry, and the riots and the Craig, and like I used to stand at the top of our street. You could go to both ends of our street. The top end of the street, you look down towards a place called Rosemount. It's just, you know, in the great scheme of things, a couple of 100 yards down the hill, and you were watching riots going on down there. Then you'd run to the other end where we overlooked the bogside, and you could see the riots going on down there. And then eventually there was a factory place near the bottom of our street, and the army took up position in there. And you could, you know, you were very close to the riots at that stage. You know, you stood far enough back, but you could see everything that was going on and see rubber bullets being fired and see tear gas canisters being fired, all from a reasonably safe distance. And then, you know, there was a fear around the area. You sensed all that. You know, that these, I remember there was a man beaten to death in Derry by the B Specials, a man called Samuel Devenny. Where the B Specials, which was a branch of the police, went into his home and beat him to a pulp in his home. There's talk that there was blood on the ceiling of his house.
Jesus.
And that went round the area. And you had this fear, the B Specials are coming in. You know, they're going to switch off the electricity. They're going to switch off the water to the area. And so you're becoming very aware of all those things happening in those early days. And then the barricades going up and the people gathering stones for riots and all that. So at that point in time, you were very aware of what was going on in your area and what was there was this, you were totally clued in. The parts that I was referring to earlier were the very early stages where there would have been people going to marches, there would have been protests and all that sort of stuff, but they hadn't really spilled on to major violence in the streets. And there would have been, a knowledge of the sort of discriminatory laws or stuff like that there, or but there wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have filtered through to me heavily, really. I was protected from it as a child, really. It was only around 69, 70 that the gloves started to come off and they began to see things that no child should ever have to witness.
Sure. If I were to ask, if I came along and asked like 8 or 9 year old Richard at the time it, during a riot, if I said, look, what's going on? Why are these two groups fighting? Are they the non-soldiers? Are they hooligans or bad people? Like if I had asked you, would you have had a positive view of the rioters, and would you have been able to explain it somewhat like to a stranger?
I think you would have attempted it. You would have been able to say some very simple things that you picked up. What's it's, if it's a, if it was armed, if it's if it was with the army or if there were riots with the army, you would say the army's coming on to raid the area and the people, all the men in the neighborhood are out to protect us. Like at the top of our street, for example, we had a vigilante hut.
Or
Which was a hut like an old like a workman's hut. And that was placed at the bottom. When you go into a building site in Ireland anywhere, you would have seen a hut where the workmen used to go and take their cups of tea and that when they're in the building
right.
site. Well, it would have been a hut like that. And the men in the area would have been in those at night. So like I would have been aware of that as a child, and you would have been aware that the men were there to protect the area. And you would have been sort of saying things like, ah, the British Army or the B Specials are going to come in nobody would be looking forward to what they're going to be doing and attack the neighborhood and stuff like that. And the men of the neighborhood are out trying to protect that. That's would have been your view. Protect the neighborhood,
I see. I see. You saw them as a protector's role.
The rioters, you would have, and then you would have been aware that you would have been aware of the Protestant Catholic thing as well. You would have been aware that it was Protestants versus Catholics and Catholics versus Protestants and stuff like that. You would have been aware of that.
Okay, given that we'll get on to it. Given that your life was irreversibly changed by a British soldier. You constantly hear that when the British Army got brought in at first, even in like the Catholic and nationalist areas, they were kind of given like a good enough greeting. You hear about people giving them cups of tea and toast and stuff. Was that the case? Like amongst your family in your area, what was there like a period initially where there was a kind of a favorable view of
Yes.
more.
Yes, I can remember that. I can remember the soft top Land Rovers. And I don't know if you know what the soft top is, but the soft top were kind of Land Rovers that were covered in canvas, really. They had no that they weren't a me it was like a open top vehicle that were the sides and the roof was made of canvas.
Right.
So I can remember these soft top army vehicles parked on our street. And I remember the military police guys all been there, they were all sort of different types of uniforms, but more what you might describe as fashionable uniforms, when them in the area and the people there bringing them out cups of tea and sandwiches and stuff like that there, because they were seen as our protectors. I remember me and my friends over talking to them, maybe running down to the shop for them. They buy them sweets or chocolate. They give us money to go down to the shop. They buy them sweets or chocolate. We come back up and give them the stuff, so there was all that sort of friendly relationship at that time. Like they were seen as coming in to save the Catholic community, to protect the Catholic community. That's how it was seen in the nationalist community or whatever words you want to describe it. But they were seen as protectors at that stage against a government in Northern Ireland which wasn't which wasn't really friendly with the nationalist community.
Given that it was only 5 months before your own sh being shot with a rubber bullet, do you remember much about Bloody Sunday? Given you're in Derry too, of course.
I do. I remember a lot about Bloody Sunday. First of all, my uncle Jerry was shot dead on Bloody Sunday, so it was very much a family thing. So it had at the core. And what I remember about Bloody Sunday was there are a couple of things I would say about Bloody Sunday. You know, in the lead up to Bloody Sunday and all the stuff was happening, to me as a child, to be honest, it seemed like a movie. You know, it was exciting to watch all this live sort of stuff playing out in front of you. And, you know, our playgrounds with barricades, our street, all the pavements dug up and all that. And you see adults driving around these trucks and hijacked vehicles, the buses setting fire. It was exciting. And that's the only way I can describe it. You know, but when Bloody Sunday happened, I think that that was certainly, I can remember. I can actually remember as well as I'm sitting here now talking to you that it was a changing moment for me and my mind. You know, a dark cloud or a curtain come down that it doesn't seem like a movie anymore to me. And like, but I remember that day was I was out in the street as usual playing football. We always played football in the street. There were no football pitches or anything like that. And there wasn't that many cars in those days, so you had the whole road to play football at. And I remember seeing different people from the neighborhood all making their way up to Bishop's Field, which at the top of Craigan was like a football pitch called Bishop's Field, and they used to get the gallery there for the march to commence. And to be honest, the civil rights marches were happening regular enough in those days, as far as I remember. And you know, it wasn't unusual to see all the men on a Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock or half one, and woman, young woman, all making their way up to the march. And of course, it was being discussed in the house in the morning. You know, brothers not saying, are you going to the march today? You want the march or getting your dinner before you go to the march and all that sort of stuff, you know. So it was all that sort of thing. But the marches were always seen as a carnival atmosphere. It was a day out, you know. As much as there was a serious message, people got up there, there was music playing, they met their friends, they met girlfriends, you know. So, like, people were just being people as well as the serious element to it. And then the next thing, we were down at the end of our street then, and we noticed people starting to come back from the march. And I remember seeing one man that lived in the street above my street. And he was coming up the hill and he shouted to somebody, there's murder down there. And he had tears in his eyes. Now, I can't say if it was tears in his eyes because of his emotions or what was it because of the CS gas? I don't know. Because the army fired a lot of CS gas at the rioters. It made, you know, it caught your ears and nose and or your eyes and nose and stuff like that. But he had tear in his eyes and he says there's murder down there. And then I was back up in the street with my friends that evening, probably around maybe 6 or 7 o'clock. I began to get, you know, well, the street lights were all on and all that sort of stuff. And I saw my uncle Willie McKinney, arrive in our street. My uncle Willie lived in Donegal. So we really only saw my uncle Willie on Sundays. And it wasn't every Sunday, but he would call up to visit my mammy and visit our house on a Sunday, him and his wife. But there, so there, so, the, but on a Sunday, so that wouldn't have been unusual, but then he normally called up at like 2 o'clock on a Sunday and he'd be away home by 6 or 7 o'clock. But he just arrived. I seen him arriving. And I seen him leaving. And it was all, he looked very serious. And he didn't look left or right, nor maybe a very jolly sort of man waving or whatever. But he just went straight out in his car. And then I saw my brother Liam arriving. He's the oldest fella in our house. And he came in, parked the car, and went straight into our house in a hurry. So again, you know, you're young. You don't fully, you remember these things more than fully registered them at the time. And then I went into the house anyway because it was my time to go home, you know, go to bed. And when I went into the house, my mommy was sitting crying in the living room. And she called me over and she says, your Uncle Jared was shot dead today.
Jesus.
And then I sat in a sofa, and my daddy was there, one or two of my brothers was there, and the only thing that was on in our house was the television. And everybody was just watching the news. And these news reports are coming in, six people shot dead today in the streets of Derry, and then eight people, and so on and so on. And then my mommy, between crying and stuff, was beginning to wonder where some of our sons were. Where's Martin? Where's Noel? Where's Gregory? Where's Jim? And you know, like, I had seven brothers older than me, and that, and they all gradually arrived under the house, you know. And then come with that were stories. They all had stories. They were all at the march. You know, one brother talked about having to crawl down a street on his hands and knees. Another brother was about to run out. They helped somebody, and somebody else pulled him to the ground. You know, because, and you know, about how the near misses that they all had. So that was that. And then the next day, my brother Noel took me for a run in his car and took me down the bogside to show me where all the people were shot. And you were looking at all the different massive pools of blood, congealed blood on the ground at different locations, you know. And then I think that night and the night afterwards, I went over to my Uncle Jared's wake. And I can always see my Aunt Ida, who's passed away now, Jared's husband, Jared's wife, who was very heavily pregnant at the time. She gave birth to their ninth child 3 weeks after Bloody Sunday. But I remember her sitting in a chair, and she was completely and utterly out of it, like. And you know, and then, but all of that had an impact. But the changing part for me was when I went into the Craigan Chapel, where I went every Sunday, and I saw 13 coffins on the altar. That's something I never saw before. And it was just that, to me, that was when the moment changed for me. When I can remember this feeling, this dark cloud, or this curtain coming down on something that, to be honest with you, seemed like a bit of crack. And then it wasn't a bit of crack anymore when you see that. That image, I still have that. I can see that image as clear as I'm talking to you.
Did Bloody Sunday mark a turning point in your mind, like in relation to how you viewed British soldiers, who before you hadn't you didn't have like an adversarial relationship with them before? Did this change it, your view of them?
Maybe not British soldiers, although well, I mean, it's hard, I suppose. At that time, you realized then that the British soldiers were not friendly people. You know, that they were, you know, there was a fear that came over me about British soldiers. And but you realize too that, you know, that you were, that there was an enemy. There
Right.
was somebody out there that, in some way, was able to do things that, and get away with it, you know. It wasn't any, like, I didn't get deeply angry or anything like that, or I didn't have any deep feelings of hatred or anything like that there. Definitely not. It was more like a sober realization that, you know, there were people out there who were prepared to kill other people, and people from my community, and people from my family. for no apparent reason.
Was your uncle one of the people who would get falsely accused of either having a nail bomb or being a gunner or being an IRA member?
Well, sure, they were all falsely accused. They were all falsely accused. Not one of them are guilty of anything.
Right, yeah.
So they're all falsely accused. And my uncle Jared was a father, 38 years of age, he had eight children. His hobby was photography. So you have a merch surfer photographer, it's like ice cream day children, isn't it? Or ice cream day children, a merch you can go and take pictures at.
Yeah.
And there he was. I mean, it's my uncle Jared, went out waving a, he saw a man being shot, I believe, and went out waving a white hanky and with his hands in the air. That was the eyewitness accounts. And when he was found dead, they thought he had taken a heart attack. And the reason why is because he couldn't see the bullet entry wounds. And the reason why they couldn't see those was because the bullet entered through his armpit and went out the other armpit.
Jesus.
So, and obviously when he shot, his arms fell back down again and covered the entry and exit point. So that corroborates that he had his arms in the air. How else would a bullet enter through your armpits without going through your arm?
Right.
So, and I would also want to get that it was side on, wouldn't it? And so it was just a completely look, people can say anything in terms of, oh, they were guilty or whatever. There's absolutely no evidence. It was just a terrible thing. And the tragedy inflicted on Jared's family, like all the other families, has been a life sentence. And it's wrong. And it's bad enough being innocently killed, but then to be told that you deserved it. It's just cruelty beyond words. But Jared was a real family man. He got my mother's first tumble dryer washing machine. He was always up with my mammy. She had a big family. They hadn't got a lot, He was a good, kind person. And he was carrying his prayer book that day, And if you go to the Bloody Sunday Museum in Derry, his little prayer book sitting in there, that he had with him that day. So that's the type of man my Uncle Jared was. And I think that's typical of all the people who were shot dead that day.
Right. I might we might fast forward there 5 months to the day that you were shot, not with a bullet, thankfully, but a rubber bullet. Can you take me through what you remember from that day?
Yeah, I mean, I was at school. I was 10 years of age at the time. It was the 4th of May, 1972, and it was just 3 months after Bloody Sunday, John. And Bloody Sunday happened the end of January, and I was shot at the beginning of May, so February, March, April, sort of thing. And I just got out of school as normal, obviously. Well, not obviously for people who wasn't there, but the school was on the edge of the Craigan Estate. It was a no-go area. There was a police station beside the school. The British Army were there protecting the police station permanently. You see these permanent military installations positioned there. And one of these military huts faced into the playground of the school. And me and my friends got out of school about 20 past 3 in the afternoon, and somebody started a race We all started to race towards one of the school gates to go home. And in doing that, he had to pass a British Army lookout post. We're running along the bottom of the playground, and a soldier fired a rubber bullet, which hit me in the bridge of the nose and blinded me permanently. So I was only about 10 feet away from it when the soldier fired the bullet, you know. And the next thing I remember is I woke up and I was lying on the school canteen or the school refectory table where my music teacher, Mr. Giles Doherty, lifted me and he heard a bang. He found me and lifted me and carried me over and put me on the school canteen table. And I remember him asking me my name and I told him my name was Richard Murr. And that's what I remember that day.
Given we'll get to your actual meeting of this particular soldier that happened years later. But si since you have spoken to him, what did he think that he was doing? Was it a misfire? Did he think he saw like a legitimate threat or?
Well, the soldier would say that, in his view, rubber bullets didn't cause any damage. And he fired the rubber bullet to get the children to bugger off home, unquote. That would be his words. Fired the rubber bullet to get the children to bugger off home.
From 10 feet.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
And and when he fired the rubber bullet, he said that I asked him, was he saying that I was a rioter? And he said, no, he says, I didn't even see you. So when he fired the rubber bullet, he would say that I wasn't a target and that he never meant to blind a 10-year-old boy. And he wishes now, with the benefit of hindsight, that he never fired the rubber bullet. But he's not going to pretend. He said, when I fired it, I meant to fire it. But I never meant to cause the damage it caused, is what he would say.
So, like in his mind, he was trying to get, like a group of, I assume the other kids were around the same age, like a group of 10-year-old boys to disperse.
I mean, in my view, there wasn't even a dispersal issue, but depends on what we mean by that, of course. But if you imagine the school playground is an enclosed area, there are no access to the general public. The army lookout post was wedged into a gap between a row of terrace houses. But the terrace houses backed onto the school, and that they didn't face onto the school. And all the kids, you know, you had a couple of hundred children that got out of school. And you're right, they were all roughly my age, some younger. And they were racing along the school. And when Charles fired the rubber bullet, you know, he fired it to get those children to bugger off home. You know, it wouldn't have been unusual for the children. Some days it would happen, some days it wouldn't. They'd be shouting things at the military on the way past. Or if somebody saw a stone lying on the ground, they would have lifted it and thrown it at this corrugated iron installation. Like, you couldn't see the soldiers.
Right.
They were inside a protected hut. They looked out through a porthole, but you couldn't see them. They were too far back. You didn't even know if there was anybody in it. Like, that was there to protect the soldiers against bombs and bullets. So if there was a bit of rubble lying on the ground, I wouldn't have thought of past the odd youngster to grab it and throw it and run like blue blazes, because you're teachers. were standing watching. It wasn't like you were left your own devices. And so, but they would have shouted things in the way past. I did it myself. Get out of Ireland. You know, whenever you heard the Arabs saying, you would have shouted and ran on, thinking you were a big boy. But there was no risk whatsoever to the army, none whatsoever. And as I say, Charles fired it to get the chutney bugger off him.
Do you remember how your family first took the news when you were I guess when you met them for the first time after that having happened?
My family. Well, my daddy and my sister arrived as I was getting under the ambulance because I only lived 2 minutes' walk from the school. So my daddy and my sister were there right away. Like, I remember my daddy holding my hand and stuff. And then over at the hospital, obviously I was 2 weeks in the hospital, John, right? And the first week, I don't really remember that much. I was on intensive care. They thought I was going to die from the injuries. Then they thought I might have brain damage. And then finally, they told my parents I'd be blind for the rest of my life. But then they moved me out into a general ward. And I remember sitting there, or I remember all my family sitting around the bed all the time, and stuff like that. I don't remember any. I remember me, like when I got out of hospital and I was in bed at night. My parents were converted to devout Catholics. They went to Mass every day of their lives. They never supported violence in any way. And they were just two lovely, loving, caring parents. I always say they were perfect people, and they were. And when I got out of hospital, and the impact of me being blind was enormous on the whole family, but enormous on my mommy and daddy. And you imagine her seeing her 10-year-old boy who 2 weeks earlier was out in the backyard playing football, trying to keep a ball up, trying to play fancy flips and all that sort of stuff with a ball, and just being a child, a happy child. And now I was tripping over a slipper in the middle of their living room floor. I was walking onto a half open wall, or half open door. I was having to put my hand on the wall to guide myself along. And she's sitting looking at that. And it was broke her heart. And I remember one night, I was in my bed and my mommy thought I was sleeping. And she came up and knelt beside my bed and started to say her prayers. And then she'd break down and start to cry. And the crying would get out of control. And she'd be saying things like, "Look at him, God. He's only a 10-year-old boy. Please give him back his eyesight. Please give him back his eyesight." And she was pleading with God for a miracle. And then I kind of, I would, when I would really out of control, I used to pretend to wake up and then she'd pull herself together a bit, So for her and my daddy, it was very difficult. And sometimes, I have two Achilles heels when I talk. One is about my children, and the other is about my mommy and daddy.
Of course. At various stages, like through your preteens and teens, what was there a desire in your heart for for revenge, or like if you if you were granted a wish and they said, look, you can blind that guy as well and he can get what you got, do you think you would have done it?
No, it never occurred to me. It's funny when you look back at it. I had never any sense of a person done this to me. It's funny. I knew I was shot. Like, it wasn't like I was living on some sort of blissful ignorance. I knew I was shot. I knew I was shot by a soldier and all that. But I never felt another human being done this to me. You know?
As you felt like an entity had like the British Army.
But I felt, you know, but the British Army done it, but I never ever remember dealing with the perpetrator in my head. I just dealt with blindness.
Really?
And I dealt with the focus of trying to lead a normal life and get back to school and deal with all the challenges that blindness brought for me. But never did I think about, well, you know, I didn't sort of have these feelings of, you know, some guy did this to me. There's a guy, you know, a bastard or anything else you want to call them. You can edit that out if you want, by the way. But no, I never felt anything like that at all. Not at all. And
Interesting.
I honestly think if I had met him then, I would have been friendly with him.
Well,
And I can't explain it. I can't explain it.
I assume the same wouldn't have been true of like your various siblings and your parents. They would they have been as I guess not forgiving, but like would they have focused their ire on the actual soldier, do you think?
I think some of my brothers were very angry. My older brothers, they were very angry. Very angry with the British Army, very angry with the soldier. And, you know, I probably didn't see the half of it, but I know they were very angry.
Right.
You know, I think my mommy and daddy were just brokenhearted. I don't remember them saying an angry word. It was just,
Really?
yeah, that's true. It was just tears. I remember one time, don't know, I keep saying just after I was shot, but you know when you're young like that, it could have been 6 months after I was shot, it could have been 3 months, whatever. But I remember I was sitting in our living room, and we lived in a small house, like, and my mommy was out in the kitchen. And that's where my mommy spent her day. You know, she hand washed all the clothes and put them through the tumble dryer, whatever. Or not the tumble dryer, that wasn't even around in those days. It was what do you call that?
Washing machine.
Yeah, you know the twin tub washing machine that my uncle Jared bought her. And she spent her day in the kitchen. And I remember my brother was out with her, and he said there, he was shouting at her. My brother was 17 or 18 at the time. As I say, it was just about 3 months after her child, let's say. And he was shouting at her, and he says, "They murdered my Uncle Jared. They blinded Richard. It's time to get our own back."
Right.
And my mommy said then, "If you want to help Richard, go in there and help Richard. But you're not helping Richard by helping somebody else."
Interesting.
So there was anger with my brothers, but there was compassion with my mom and dad, I think.
I see. At any stage during like your childhood and teens, was there ever an attempt by any politician or political group to kind of use you as I suppose as like a political tool, in that it would be absolute gold in the kind of PR side of it to be able to wheel out a 10-year-old boy who had been blinded by British soldiers and use that as to win kind of hearts and minds. Was that ever attempted by anyone?
No, I have to be totally honest and say, John, I've never been used in that way. I don't remember ever being used in that way. I have to be honest.
Good.
You know, for whatever reason, you know, but I and maybe there's no reason other than the fact that just people wouldn't do that. I don't know, but I've never nobody's ever attempted to encourage me to, be at the front of a march or to get up onto a podium or, wheel me out and stuff, things like that. I remember being taken to the odd concert and, brought on stage, but it was normally to give a donation to my family to just help and stuff, but never anything else.
Okay, good. Look, we've only got 10 minutes left, so
Yeah.
I won't keep you too long. But can you take me to the time in your life when you eventually made contact with and then met the soldier in question?
Yeah, what happened was, as I got older, all of that sort of stuff, and if you had time, there's a lot of stuff to get into. But as I got older, I was always curious. When I began to think that, about the other person, I can't really click when that was really. But anyway, I began to think, you know what, the, you know, there's another person in my life here that played a major role in my life, and I don't know who it is, and so I got curious about the person. At some point in time, I began to realize, there's another person in my life that played a significant role in my life. The person I am, the personality I've developed, the life's journey that I've gone, the choices I had to make, in many ways, were controlled by something that day. And when you peel everything back, there's only two people involved, and that's me and the person that fired the rubber bullet. So at times I felt like I was looking under a shadow, that there was a corner of a room where a person existed, and I didn't know who they were or anything about them. So as I was interviewed by journalists over the years, I kept saying I would love to meet the soldier someday. And I did want to meet him. I did, I was curious about him. But I said it that many times that it's nearly like automatic pilot. And then eventually around 2004, 2005, the BBC commissioned a documentary to be made about my story. And it was a Belfast company that was doing it, and they chased down the soldier and they found him. And then I wrote a letter to him, they hand delivered it. And he wrote a letter back to me. And that was the beginning of the journey to meet the soldier, really.
Right.
So eventually I met Charles in January 2006. And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life as well. Because I knew by that stage that I had forgiven the soldier. I never looked at my story or what I was experiencing as forgiveness. But I began to realize what I was experiencing was forgiveness.
I see.
And but it's one thing to forgive somebody. It's another thing to tell them you forgive them. And I would always describe that as the fullness of forgiveness. And when I met Charles that day, it was an amazing thing for me. And I suppose he was no longer a soldier. He was Charles. He was a grandfather. He was a husband. He was a father. He was a brother. And I began to see a person. And once you meet the person, then everything changes as well. Not that too much had to change within me, but definitely I got friendly with him. And I still am friendly with him, still good friends.
Did he speak to you that time or in other conversations about how that affected him, the fact that he had accidentally blinded a child? did it haunt him the rest of his life?
I think in fairness, it didn't haunt him. Charles was a captain in the army when he shot me, and he was a major when he retired. You could ask him this, but I mean, that's what I think. I think that, as time would go by for Charles, that he said at the start he felt, well, he said, that he felt bad. Although in the letter that he sent me on the first communications, he did say that he didn't feel guilty. But, when you talk to him, sometimes he does say he felt guilty. And, and he was devastated at the time, he said, when he was told that he had nearly killed a 10-year-old boy, but he had actually left a 10-year-old boy permanently blind. And because he had children around that age himself. And so, I think I'm being honest, John, I never wanted to meet a gibbering wreck. I didn't want to meet somebody whose life was destroyed because of what they did to me. And I suppose I got what I asked for. And I really don't mind that. Charles dealt with it and moved on, I think.
Did you ever get the sense from meeting him that your forgiveness was important to him?
Well, I don't know. I think it probably was. I think he appreciated it, but I think by that stage, it probably moved on anyway. I don't
Right.
know that. I don't fully know the answer to that, John, but I think, I think he would appreciate the fact that I was able to forgive him after what happened. I think he would appreciate that, all right,
I see.
And I think you've got to be careful about your forgiveness, Forgiveness can give you a very high moral ground. And to me, that's not the true use of forgiveness. I don't want Charles to feel I'm a great fellow or he's a lesser being because I am bestowing some kind of forgiveness on him. To me, it's not like that. It's much softer, it's much warmer, it's much more compassionate. And I forgive Charles in my heart. I forgive Charles in my mind. And it's up to Charles what he takes out of that himself. But, because forgiveness was never about Charles, forgiveness was about me. Me
Interesting.
forgiving Charles was about me finding happiness, me finding contentment, me finding a way in my life to be able to doably respond to what happened to me in a way that was comfortable for me. If Charles benefits from my forgiveness, then that's great. But I've forgiven Charles long before I met him. But at the same time, meeting him, I've been able to tell him I forgive him. That's when you get to the fullness of forgiveness. And again, it's a benefit to me. If Charles wants it, great. If he doesn't want it, that's great too.
I see. We've come to the end of our time. I appreciate everything you've shared, all the memories and thoughts and everything. Would there be anything you'd want to leave us with there? Just anything you wanted to just kind of tell the audience that you think is important?
Well, the only thing I would say, John, is look, no matter who you are, you will be faced with challenges in your life. We all are. And what's important is how you respond to those challenges. And the reason why I'm such a happy person and I was able to get on with my life in such a balanced way is because I didn't harbor any feelings of hatred or anger. And if you can do that, you are a much happier person because anger only hurts you. And I know it's not easy. And because I'm saying it, doesn't mean that it's easy, though. It was easy for me, and I don't know why that was. But there may be people listening to this podcast that don't find forgiveness easy. And that's okay as well. You're not a lesser person than me or anybody else. You're just a human being. So don't feel bad about it. But if you can get there with it, and I hold up my story and the hope that it provides a bit of light for somebody who's trying to navigate the way through some kind of hurt and pain that they've experienced in their life.
Very good. Thank you very much. Thank you again, Richard. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, John. Thanks for taking the time.